Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This week, California Governor Jerry Brown gave his annual State of the State address. He talked about a number of issues like the drought and inequality, but he didn't talk about specific programs. He said, quote, "In the face of growing inequality, California has not been passive," end quote. But as the LA Times' John Myers reports, Democrats criticized Brown for not speaking to the needs of low-income seniors or those who are disabled. And others said a glaring omission was what to do about residents who can't afford housing. State Senator Mark Leno, a Democrat from San Francisco, said, "We've got a housing crisis in California, and there wasn't a word about housing." Governor Brown's State of the State address comes just a few weeks after he released his whopping $170 billion budget, which is being criticized by advocates for the poor. The Sacramento Bee's Dan Walters reports that from the onset of Brown's second governorship in 2011, he's been reluctant to expand safety net services to the poor, openly fearing that new entitlements would lead to deep budget deficits. The politics of poverty have become more contentious because California's recovery from the Great Recession has revealed the state's increasingly stark economic disparities. Many reports are out showing that California has the highest poverty rate among seniors in the country. So how are reporters covering the state of the state? Why are so few reporters covering the state's 15 million people who are poor or living in near poverty? That is according to the Public Policy Institute of California. And then, as we've done so many shows about this, many people who are making a decent income are having a hard time making ends meet. Joining us to talk about how reporters are covering these issues are three guests. Tim Redmond is founder and editor of 48 Hills, an online nonprofit San Francisco Progressive Daily, and former editor of The Bay Guardian. And Tim has some good news about The Bay Guardian. Hi, Tim. Thanks for coming
in. Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Gail Holland, an award-winning journalist and staff writer with the LA Times, where she covers homelessness and poverty. Gail joins us from Los Angeles. Hi, Gail. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Philip Reese, an award-winning journalist and staff writer with the Sacramento Bee. And Philip joins us from Sacramento. Hi, Philip. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that really stood out for all of you this week. So Tim Redmond, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm going to step away from the budget for a second and talk about local coverage. I thought that Josh Sabatini's article in the San Francisco Examiner yesterday, where he traces dubious campaign contributions to the mayor from a company that later got a city contract, and connects this to two people who were involved in a $10,000 bribe. This, of course, all goes back to the Shrimp Boy case and the FBI investigation. And I think the way that Josh explained a very, very complicated story. His lead says, "The pair who allegedly solicited, with Mayor Ed Lee's knowledge, a $10,000 bribe to help retire his campaign debt, also arranged $1,500 in campaign contributions with an employee of a lumber company that later received a city contract." And they did this by doing kind of old-fashioned investigative reporting. They went and got the documents, and they got the emails under the Sunshine Ordinance, and they traced where this money came from. And it reflects on what many call the pay-to-play politics of the Ed Lee administration. So I think they did a real good job with that.
Has the Ed Lee administration responded?
Oh, of course. They say that everything they did was perfectly legal.
Okay. And so then from there, as a journalist, what do you do?
Well, I think what we've seen in San Francisco is a pattern of these stories where little bit by little bit you're seeing pieces of, you can't call it corruption if nobody's proven lawbreaking, but a pattern of people who give money getting favors, and of insiders and outsiders in the administration. And so I think this is the kind of story that journalists need to be pursuing every day on a regular basis, because it's not like many times, it's not the one contribution. It's not the one $1,500 contribution from the lumber company that then gets a city contract that shows what's going on. It's the pattern of 20 of them or 30 of them or 40 of them. And so I think that people just have to continue to pursue this and not look at it as say, and a lot of times it's easy for journalists to say, oh, it's only one contribution. Oh, it's only this much money. Oh, it's not that big a deal, and let it go. When in fact, if we keep looking at this stuff piece by piece by piece, you get a pattern.
Right. And then, but in order to do that, you need a beat reporter who specifically follows these issues,
You need a beat
right?
reporter who follows this, and you need time. I mean, the thing about even straightforward investigative reporting is it takes time. We're all under so much pressure in the media these days to fill the paper and to get, and you know, the Examiner's got a very, very small staff. The Chronicle staff is way smaller than it used to be. Everyone's had layoffs. And so it's the challenge to convince management that it's worth taking, even in some cases, a day. You know, in some cases, all it takes is a day, 12 hours, 16 hours to pursue a story that's not going to be necessarily tomorrow's lead story, but in 3 days, it's going to be a much bigger story. So that's one of the challenges we face right now, is just finding the time to do this.
And just quickly, Tim, since you gave kudos to Josh Sabatini with the San Francisco Examiner, what do you think of the Examiner these days?
Well, I think that they're doing a really good job with a small staff. I think they've really improved their coverage. They've got a lot of excellent young reporters. And, the challenge is, they have a small paper with small space and a small staff, and that's a fight that we're all having right now.
Yep, and the Examiner is free. You can find it.
You can find it. Yeah,
and a box on the corner.
You can find it in a box on the corner.
Yeah.
And the other thing about the Examiner that I think they've done the right thing is they only focus local. Mm. You know, the Cron still tries to fill a lot of its pages with national and international news, and the problem with that is people don't look to the Chronicle for that. People look to the San Francisco. These days, there's so much national and international news on the internet. If you want to know what's going on elsewhere in the world, you don't go to the San Francisco Chronicle. So I actually think that all of those resources would be better put. You go from page 3 to page 12, whatever, in the Chronicle, and it's basically AP and New York Times reports from somewhere else in the world or somewhere else in the country. No one reads that in the Chronicle. I think those pages and that space would be better put to use doing more local investigative reporting, because that's what you get from a local paper.
Yeah. Tim Redmond is founder and editor of 48 Hills, an online nonprofit San Francisco Progressive Daily, and former editor of The Bay Guardian. And what about you, Gail Holland? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Our superb columnist, Steve Lopez, who wrote the book that was the basis for the movie The Soloist, about his friendship with a homeless musician and how he got him off the streets after decades. He wrote, I thought, an astonishing column during our first big El Nino storm. He went out to a extremely developed encampment where the guy had a double bed and a dresser and all this under a freeway overpass, and was there when the waters actually rose and carried the guy's camp away. And to me, it was a very beautiful story, and it was also it was almost like a biblical parable of what happens when we haven't dealt with this problem and a natural disaster, or it's not even a disaster, it's just a weather condition, El Nino strikes. People had been writing about this for weeks, like worrying about what was going to happen, and here was such a great illustration of exactly what's going to happen. Mm.
You have also written about, you wrote a piece about a homeless woman who died of exposure on a Skid Row sidewalk during the El Nino storm, and we'll talk about that later in the show. Do you know what happened to that man that Steve Lopez wrote about?
I believe he, as happens every time, he just relocated and... within, you know, one of the big issues here has been clearing people's things, but the camps, they just reappear and repopulate with furniture and this kind of thing, because there's a lot of people that go around donating this kind of thing because out of humanitarian concerns, because when you think about it, people who are stuck in the street, they can't just walk around for 12 hours. I actually tried it once.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we're definitely going to talk about that later in the show, because we are seeing kind of a smallish tent city. Definitely does not compare to Skid Row, but we're seeing so many tents now on Division Street in San Francisco, and I've never seen so many tents there before. So we'll talk about that on today's show. That's Gail Holland. She's an award-winning journalist and staff writer with the LA Times, and she covers homelessness and poverty. The city of Los Angeles recently issued a state of emergency on homelessness. And what about you, Philip Reese? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, just before you called, I was reading an article by Max Rosenthal for Mother Jones. He wrote about how the Pentagon doesn't know how many weapons it's lost to the Islamic State. Did some pretty deep and good reporting on that issue, and pointed out that the Iraqi government does not have a database of any sort keeping track of of weapons, and because of that, there's great suspicion that a lot of these weapons are winding up in the wrong hands. But no one knows exactly how deep the problem is.
And is anyone doing anything about this?
Well, besides writing Inspector General reports and saying that there's a real problem, it does not look like there's a whole lot being done. There's a few Pentagon spokespeople quoted saying that it almost seems like they're not saying much with their quotes. But there's not a whole lot of reaction and not a whole lot of sense of urgency, that at least in this report.
And also, Congress is currently looking at billions of dollars wasted in Afghanistan, but that's just a never-ending story.
Mm.
Well, all right, so thank you. Kudos to Max Rosenthal of Mother Jones, and that is Philip Reese. He's an award-winning journalist and staff writer for the Sacramento Bee, and we will put links to all of these stories at yourcallradio.org. So let's dive in and talk about California Governor Jerry Brown's annual State of the State. There's always a lot of attention on these addresses. He talked about a number of issues but didn't talk about specific programs. Most headlines have been about Governor Brown stressing fiscal restraint. First of all, Tim, as a reporter, what do you look for in a speech like this?
Well, you look for any signs of new policies or new changes. You look for any specific proposals that they're going to make. Jerry has a tendency to make very short speeches, unlike, the president's State of the Union or even Mayor Ed Lee's State of the City, which tend to go on for a long time. His State of the State speech was short, and he didn't really say a whole lot. And that is very Jerry Brown-like. What I think I also look for as a reporter in a speech like this is what's not there. What didn't he say? What didn't he talk about? Now, the interesting thing here is that he, of course, I think he's the first governor ever to predict a recession and to say basically, and he's not wrong, to say basically we should be preparing not for boom times but for bad times. And he's not wrong about that. But what he didn't say in all of his accomplishments and all of the things that he talked about, what he didn't say is that for a lot of state agencies and a lot of services that serve the people of California, their budget is still pre-2007 levels. That during the recession, there were all these cuts and all these reductions, and they haven't been filled. We haven't gotten back to zero. So he talks about the coffers are flowing and we have to save all this money, but he never talks about restoring the cuts that we had to make during the bad times. And those, these are things that affect people's lives. We can talk about housing and homelessness. Money, state money for housing in cities is at levels from a decade ago. And the problem is just getting worse. Oh, by the way, there's a connection between these two things. Yeah. The fact that we don't have the kind of money we used to have, and the problems are getting worse. So I think in his kind of zen-like, let's prepare for the future and put this aside, there's a lot he didn't say.
Gail, as someone who covers homelessness and poverty, what do you look for in a speech like this?
Well, there wasn't much for me to look at because there wasn't, as the previous guest has pointed out, though he didn't address any of the things that I cover. The only thing that I found interesting is when he made this so-called joke about continuing on in power, and I wondered, I think usually statements like that have something to them. I wonder what role he sees for himself and if he would play any role in perhaps out of office in addressing these problems in a more serious way. I also noticed the same thing that your previous guest said, that there's always this assumption that the recession is over and that all these funding levels have been restored, but in fact, homelessness, both services and housing, are way down from what they were even 7 or 8 years ago, out of various pockets, not just the state, but the state is part of it.
And according to official numbers, there are 116,000 homeless people in California. Los Angeles City and County have the most chronically homeless people in the country. As you reported in a recent piece, Gail, homelessness in L.A. overall grew 12% from 2013 to 2015.
Yes, in the previous 2 years, it also grew a similar amount. In addition to that, they actually lopped off type of a demographic analysis that they used to use that would have pushed the numbers even higher. I don't know if they were hoping that that would give them better news in 2015, but it didn't. And in addition to that, almost everybody I speak to, well, first off, there's camps everywhere all over L.A., and it's kind of revelatory to see people's absolute shock when it comes into neighborhoods where they've never been seen. And at the same time, Skid Row in downtown, the traditional epicenter of homeless people living outside, most of the really long-term observers of that whole scene say that it's as bad as it's ever been.
Wow. And, Philip, you are in Sacramento, and you do a lot of number crunching for the Sacramento Bee. A recent piece you wrote about high poverty areas in Sacramento being hit by crime, you found that violent crime is up 24% compared with 2013. 2014. Property crime is up 8%, and it's just on the rise. So as someone who crunches these numbers and looks at poverty and crime in Sacramento, what are you looking for in this speech?
Well, I thought it was interesting that he did touch on inequality some, but he mostly blamed income inequality on national trends that were sort of beyond the state's control, and he tried to lay out a few things that he had done the state government had done to mitigate the problem. But really, I mean, we're seeing a pretty significant increase in the amount of income inequality in California. You're seeing here in Sacramento, from 2007 to 2014, we saw about a 27% decline in household income among the poorest 20%, while the income for the richest 20% actually rose slightly after adjusting for inflation. So it's a very big issue, and it's being talked about more and more, and it was interesting to me that he spent a little bit of time on it, but was not really willing to say that there are things unique about California that may be contributing to inequality here.
So, given that, what's the jump-off point at that point, Gail? Because in your pieces, you report on California's legislators are proposing to spend $2 billion to build housing for the homeless. And you quote former Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg saying that he is absolutely frustrated with the inadequate response to homelessness by local governments, but he's hoping that an infusion of state funding will begin to address this problem. So how is this money going to be spent, $2 billion?
Well, it's money from the proposition that was approved by voters to increase funding for the treatment of the mentally ill. And it's going to be spent on permanent supportive housing, as it's called, which is housing that people have a right to. It's not, they're not put in a program and then moved out after a certain period of time. They have a right to stay there as long as they follow the rules, I guess. And it also includes services. The service component could go on for years or decades. And they're talking about spending that money as incentive to the affordable housing community to make permanent supportive housing specifically for the mentally ill. A recent estimate that we had is that each unit costs $350,000. They're counting on, at least here locally, there's a lot of talk about Medicaid covering some of these continuing services. And the idea is that these people are already using up tremendous amounts of public funds in the form of visits to the emergency rooms of public hospitals, ambulance trips, and jailings. And so actually by shifting this money to housing, that would actually save money. The problem, as it often is in government, is the upfront costs. And this is their attempt to provide some of the upfront costs to kind of jumpstart that. As far as their frustration with local officials, I wanted to bring up something, which is that the city said they were going to declare a state of emergency, but they actually didn't.
Hmm.
the city of L.A. They also, they rejected it in the end because the city attorney advised them it wouldn't have the impact that they had hoped for, a lot of which was to get additional state and federal funds. In addition, they had pledged to spend $100 million on, again, these same problems, basically housing. And they actually this year are committed to spending $30 million. So these kinds of things, I think, are some of the frustrations that I heard from the state legislators when they were here, that the city is planning, they're talking, but where's the money?
Tim, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think hasn't been reported on very well when, in terms of numbers, when we talk about numbers like this, oh, we're going to spend $2 billion on housing. Gee, that sounds like a lot of money for the state, $2 billion. Well, you know, we just heard, Gail said that it's in L.A. it's about $350,000 a unit for supportive housing. In San Francisco, it's closer to $500,000 because of property values. So do the math on that. And what are we looking at from $2 billion? Maybe 4,000 housing units across the entire state? Mm. And there's 8,000 homeless people in San Francisco alone?
They said 10 to 14,000 for whatever it's worth.
Right. That's with a local match. So 10 to 14,000 housing units across the entire state. That might solve the problem in San Francisco. 10 to 14,000 housing units in one city. How many homeless people are there in L.A.? 50,000? More than that?
44,000.
Yeah, 44,000. So this is just a tiny, tiny fraction of the need. The governor talks about we need $70 billion to fix the roads. And I'm all in favor of fixing the roads. But we actually need $70 billion to build housing in San Francisco, because that's the kind of money we need to talk about here. The number of housing units you're going to get, again, even with a local match. And typically what the state does is they say to a city, we'll give you $1 million if you put up $1 million of your own. So they, you know, and of course cities are scrambling to put up that money themselves. But even with that, even if you figure the $2 billion becomes $4 billion, it's nowhere near enough for the need.
And before we go to break, Tim, what are your thoughts about reporting on these issues? Because San Francisco is getting national and international attention because of the influx of tech money, the lack of affordable housing, poverty, and homelessness. We were just talking earlier about all of the tents we're now seeing on Division Street. And I asked a couple people who live in those tents, why have the numbers increased? And they said it's because homeless people in other parts of the city are getting kicked out. And so they're going to Division. And when it rains, the freeway is over them, so they have cover from the rain.
Yeah, you know, the numbers of homeless people in San Francisco and the wealth that's coming into the city, one of the things that I think isn't being talked about enough is the connection there, that the number one cause of homelessness in San Francisco today is eviction. Right? That's why people end up homeless. They get thrown out of the place, and they can't afford another place to live. And that is connected to the extreme wealth and the tech boom in San Francisco. It's not as if these things are just happening in the abstract. There's actually as the city gets richer, it also gets poorer. And this wealth inequality, you see the impacts on the streets every day. And of course, you know, let's not even talk about the Super Bowl and the fact that we're spending millions of dollars to support the NFL and in the process kicking homeless people out of downtown San Francisco. So, you know, I think it's important to make all of these connections.
$5 million San Francisco is going to spend on the Super Bowl. This got a lot of attention this week. Santa Clara has an agreement with the Super Bowl host committee. All of the city's costs will be reimbursed, but San Francisco does not. The mayor's office is saying it is not necessary because they believe with so many people coming here for parties, that money will be regenerated anyway.
Well, you know, we heard that about the America's Cup, that we were going to make so much money off the America's Cup that it was fine to give them a bunch of city money, and that one didn't turn out so well. So I'm not saying that we won't bring in some money from the Super Bowl, and that there are certainly a lot of people who work in the hospitality industry who'll be doing well. But I do have to ask, why is the city and county of San Francisco, with all the problems we have and all the homelessness on the streets, why are we giving a penny to the NFL, a $10 billion a year operation that has, as we all know from the movie Concussion, systematically abused its employees, that has a terrible record on things like domestic violence and drug use? I mean, why are we giving the NFL anything? That's my question.
Tim Redmond is founder and editor of 48 Hills. Gail Holland is a staff writer with the LA Times, and Philip Reese is a staff writer with the Sacramento Bee. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will talk about intervention programs working to reduce youth violence and gun violence. Gun violence is not just a criminal justice issue. It's also a public health issue. Trauma experts at UCSF are working on this. Oakland's Public Safety Council recently introduced two new ordinances regulating gun possession. So what resources are available for victims of gun violence, and how will these laws affect gun violence and youth violence in the Bay Area? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us today, we have three reporters on the show covering city government and state government here in California. What are your thoughts on how some of the state's most pressing issues are being covered in the media, whether we're talking about the rise in homelessness, poverty, people in the middle who can't make ends meet, the affordable housing crisis? Where do you go for information on these issues? And how is your local paper covering these issues? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Tim Redmond, founder and editor of 48 Hills, an online nonprofit San Francisco Progressive Daily. He's also former editor of the Bay Guardian. Gail Holland is a staff writer with the LA Times, where she covers homelessness and poverty. And Philip Reese is a staff writer with the Sacramento Bee. And Philip, we were talking earlier about how you crunch data. According to new census data, as the Bay Area recovered from the Great Recession, household incomes increased, but so did poverty rates and the cost of housing. And your work focuses on taking a lot of that data and trying to put a face on it and put a story on it. So can you talk about how you do that, especially, you know, Tim was talking about this earlier. The story about so much wealth and so much poverty is, it could be the same story because they're both affecting each other.
Yeah, it's funny that there's so many problems that are related to poverty. It feels like I write the same story many times, because the explanation for a lot of the things, like higher crime, more people visiting emergency rooms, which Gail brought up, more health problems in various areas, all come back to this issue of poverty. So a lot of it's just going out and talking to the people that are affected by these trends and the policies that that surround them.
In your latest piece that we were talking about earlier, actually wrote this in October, Sacramento violent crime rises sharply, high poverty areas hit hardest. You spoke with so many families that are directly affected by violence. Can you talk about what stood out for you? And when the people talk with you, what do they tell you in terms of what stories they want you to tell? Because you have this amazing kind of, you know, you look at downtown Sacramento where things are kind of booming, and then a five-minute walk where people are afraid to go out at night.
Yeah, so we in Sacramento, and I believe this has been a problem throughout the state, have seen an increase in crime, particularly violent crime, from 2014 to 2015. This was after years of crime decreases. A lot of it is in the areas that are already suffering the most. We had a number of homicides that were in not just poverty-stricken areas, but that mostly affected teenagers and other young people. So we're hearing from people, when we go to these neighborhoods, they want others just to know about them. Mm. They sometimes say that they feel invisible, and it's our responsibility to go out and tell their stories and remind people that even though they may not go in these neighborhoods and see them on a regular basis, they are there and they're struggling to make it.
What kind of response do you get from readers when you write stories like this?
You know, it varies. Sometimes, you know, people will call in and say, people in poor areas need to take more responsibility for their actions. They need to do more to better themselves. But there's also some compassion as well. I think people, at least the readers I hear from, are often dissatisfied with the way the world is right now. It doesn't just apply to those who are poor. We've seen for many years in a row now wages just stagnant across the Sacramento region and across California when you adjust for inflation. So the middle class, they're while they may not be seeing their incomes fall as much as the poor have in the last few years, they're still frustrated by you know, just sort of plodding along and not seeing their lives get better. I think that's a very common experience. So I think I do feel like there's some empathy out there as well.
Mm-hmm. Gail, what about you? You do extensive reporting on homelessness and poverty, a lot of stories about Skid Row in Los Angeles. What kind of response do you get from readers?
Well, I think often when you write about one particular person, often people ask if they can donate and help the people out. I think the policy things are more difficult for people to get inside of. And homelessness, we had a really excellent op-ed piece recently by a lawyer who works on Skid Row for myths about homelessness. There's so many preconceptions about homelessness, and that are not as universal as people think. And this goes way across the political lines. Like, a lot of liberals think that most of the people who are homeless, it's because of mental illness. And then a lot of people who are more conservative think that kind of what the last guest just said, that people are should need to take care of themselves better and quit using drugs and quit committing crimes and going to prison and this kind of thing. So I think for myself, I find that writing about individuals is a lot more effective in kind of getting the ideas across.
And then in those pieces, do you sometimes have room to write about why this is happening, policies that got us here? For example, a lot of the groups in San Francisco say we have to go back and look at how housing budgets have been completely slashed since the 70s.
Yeah, I don't think we've done as good a job writing about housing policy and housing finance as we might have. No, generally I like to have the people's story tell, you know, point to the policy issues, but I think that they really do. I know that here there were, you know, for weeks we were writing about people's concerns about El Nino, people, homeless people being threatened by El Nino, and there was all kinds of task force and special operations by police in the city to warn people and get them to safety, and the very first storm, a woman died of exposure on Skid Row.
Tim?
Yeah, another thing I think that we in the press need to do a better job doing, particularly when we write about homelessness and poverty, is putting it in historical context. I mean, this is something that's, you know, in 1975, there were very few homeless people in San Francisco or in Los Angeles. It's just something you didn't see, right? And that is prior to Ronald Reagan essentially cutting off federal funds that went to cities to help with these kinds of problems. You know, the vast wealth inequality we did not see in the United States in the immediate post-war era, but that was also an era where the marginal tax rate on the very wealthiest was from 80% to 90%. And if we had that in California today, we would not have the wealth inequality that we have in California today, and we would have the money to provide these kinds of services. So I think it's important to remind people, and I try to remind people whenever I can, homelessness is not something that's been with us since the dawn of this country. It's actually a relatively recent political phenomenon, and there are very specific policy decisions that were made in Washington and Sacramento that created it. And I think we need to not forget that.
And you definitely didn't see older homeless people on the streets back then.
You definitely did not see older homeless people, and you didn't see homeless families. I mean, there's a tremendous number of homeless families in San Francisco, and that's a relatively new phenomenon.
According to a report by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 20% of California adults over the age of 65 live below the poverty threshold. It's about $16,000 annually. We talk about that on this show, but a lot of people live on their Social Security checks, which can be $900 to $1,000 a month.
And which have not gone up anywhere near the increase in the cost of housing in California. You know, I mean, again, 25 years ago, when I 30 years ago now, when I first moved to San Francisco, people who lived on SSI or Social Security got enough money to pay rent in a decent apartment. Now that apartment costs 8, 10, 12, 15 times as much as it did before, and the Social Security and SSI has gone up by like 10%. Mm. So that disconnect between what we give people in terms of public subsidies and the cost of housing and the resulting increase in homelessness. I mean, that's very real. It's right out there. That's a very simple equation.
Tim Redmond is founder and editor of 48 Hills, an online nonprofit San Francisco Progressive Daily. Gail Holland is a staff writer with the LA Times, where she covers homelessness and poverty. And Philip Reese is a staff writer with the Sacramento Bee. He often crunches numbers and then puts a face to those numbers. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on the state of reporting on some of California's most pressing issues? How does your local paper cover these issues, and where do you go to find information about housing, poverty, homelessness, people in the middle who can't make ends meet, and solutions to these problems? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Dave in San Francisco. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show. Hello.
Hi, and thank you.
Hi, Dave.
Thank you, and I hope my phone is not breaking up. I'm in San Francisco. I'm Dave. My question has to do with reporting on City Hall here in San Francisco. And I may direct it to Tim Redmond. We have reporters, and the approach of having a beat reporter is what I think you spoke of earlier. Well, that'd be good, but how about having a number of reporters working on City Hall? And tell us what's going on with campaigns and special contributions. There may be a couple ways to go about this, and that's my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Well, I think we've seen, and San Francisco is not unique in this, but I think San Francisco is a perhaps more radical example, but we have seen a decline in City Hall coverage in a lot of cities, just because we've seen a decline in the number of reporters that newspapers are willing to hire and pay to do this. I agree. I mean, you know, we cannot have a functioning democracy without aggressive journalism. It just doesn't work. You have to have reporters trying to hold public officials accountable, or you can't have a functioning democracy. So I think that that's one of the challenges that we face in journalism today, is what is the economic model that allows you to do that?
Could I also say something? I think beat reporting is absolutely essential, because you really don't get anywhere with until you've really had time to talk to people off the record and really background yourself in one of the things you pointed out, the historical backdrop to things, as well as just getting to know who the players are and where their power comes from and this kind of thing. It takes a lot of time. And one of the problems, I think, in addition to cutting reporters, is that the whole web focus is very much on just jumping on something that's trending, as we all know. And this has militated a lot against beat reporting. And our paper is maintaining a beat reporting system, and I hope we still do, because otherwise you're just skimming the surface.
Gail, what is the status of reporting on L.A. City Hall?
Well, the paper is, you know, recently had a pretty large buyout. I think it was 10 to 15% of the editorial staff. And we lost a lot of institutional knowledge, because the financial deal that was offered was very much weighted to people with years of experience. At the same time, we have maintained a beat system, and we're maintaining, there's a focus going forward on accountability journalism, which is what I think we're all talking about. You know, not just reporting what the vote was, but really talking about where the money came from and who's, you know, whose ox is being gored and who's being favored because of some campaign contribution they made or some other political facet. We are maintaining the beat reporting, but I think it's really important that we have beat reporters who are given the time to do a lot of enterprise reporting and to spend the time to really talk to people, and because you can spend an awful lot of your time as a beat reporter in meetings or covering little tidbits, and the paper's attempting to do that going forward. That's all the discussions that we've had. But it gets harder every year, and then losing institutional knowledge and experience also is difficult. Mm. So I guess I take it that Tim left the Bay Guardian and started something and took all that knowledge with him, which is so great that you're able to do that. But I know the economics of going out on your own are very difficult. So
it is very difficult. And, you know, I started 48 Hills as a nonprofit, and, you know, with the kind of the KALW public radio model. We're doing okay. If someone would come along and give us a large chunk of money, we'd have more reporters. But I think that's part of it. And I agree with you. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to all of these. We see this at the San Francisco Chronicle, too. All of the buyouts and retirement packages are aimed at people who've been there a long time. And, of course, because they've been there a long time, they have higher salaries and they're more expensive. So management wants to bring in young kids who work for less, but they don't have that institutional memory and experience.
And, Philip, at the Sacramento Bee, how would you describe how it covers City Hall in Sacramento?
Well, we certainly have had our share of cutbacks like all other newspapers in the country. However, we recently hired someone to help us with our City Hall and local government coverage, so we're expanding a little bit in that area. We're also lucky that the City Hall reporter we have, Ryan Lillis, has been on the beat for a very long time and is very keyed in to what's going on. So I think we're a little bit more fortunate than most, at least for now.
Well, thank you for the question, Dave. Let's go next to Cynthia in San Francisco. Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I wanted to just talk very briefly about the framing of issues that are affecting Americans, including homelessness. As Robert Reich once said, we need to harken back to 1970s, 50s, 60s, 70s America, where government was such, a much more palpable force in Americans' lives. Conservatives are not that keen on references to European socialist countries, but they might harken back, far more to American history, in which we actually had a much more compassionate governance. And I'm, thinking that in terms of reporting and in, liberals. Agenda. And that's just a point I wanted to make.
Thank you. Yeah, Tim, your thoughts?
That's part of what I was talking about before, is that we have to look at what role government played in our lives in different eras. And I think, it's interesting, the post-World War II era, I think people looked at government as government got us out of the Great Depression and government won World War II. And then I think, people look at government very differently, and part of that is because of corruption in government. Part of it is because of things like the war on drugs, where suddenly for young people, government was sending them to die in Vietnam and put them in jail for smoking pot instead of, saving the world. But there's a lot of different reasons why we have, but I think the public in general has a much more distrustful attitude towards government. And some of that is legitimate and for good reasons, but also it creates this idea that, wow, why would we want to pay more taxes to have government solve social problems when all we hear about is government being corrupt?
Right. And I hope if you have 2 hours over the weekend, I hope you can listen to Fresh Air and Democracy Now! Interviews with Jane Mayer, mm-hmm. the New Yorker reporter who's out with a very important book called Dark Money. Mm-hmm. And she goes into these concerted campaigns by the Koch brothers and other conservatives with a lot of money who've spent the last 3 to 4 decades convincing people that government is bad. I mean, that's a simplistic way to put it, but Jane Mayer's book and what she uncovers is very important, and we're planning to get her on soon. So thank you so much for calling. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. We have a number of emails. Danielle says, I just turned you on to hear about Tim's opinions about national coverage in the Chronicle. Don't forget the elderly who are not on the internet. They're used to newspapers and aren't necessarily online. So good national coverage is essential for them. Newspapers can be a ritual for them.
Well, that is true. And that, on the other hand, I think a lot of people in San Francisco these days who are looking for national coverage and get print subscribed to the New York Times or subscribed to other publications. I agree that there are a lot of people who are not online and still need that access to newspapers. But I feel like a local newspaper needs to spend more time these days covering local events. I'm not suggesting that the Chronicle stop printing, I'm just saying I think they should focus more on what's going on in San Francisco.
We also have an email from Anna in Oakland who says, I notice most media sources in the Bay Area discuss affordable housing. I'm sure this is the case in Sacramento and L.A., and that's the go-to term heard everywhere. But what about the demand for public housing? I never hear the media or regional leaders discuss this. Sure, affordable housing is important, but so is public housing. Why aren't our local governments building public housing if they supposedly care about this issue so much?
Well, I think public housing is, it's one of those, it's an anathema. It has a very bad profile and reputation. In fact, permanent supportive housing is a form of public housing. And it does kind of raise the dilemma, and I think that really a lot of people use the word affordable housing because it's more politically palatable. But one of, I think, the dilemmas in the housing field is if you're building permanent supportive housing for homeless people, what about the people who are living in substandard, terrible housing, doubling and tripling up with other families and family members because their wages are so inadequate to market rates? And that's certainly a situation in Los Angeles. I think San Francisco has pushed a lot of those people out, but in Los Angeles, there's a lot of substandard housing, and I think it does raise kind of a tension between who should the government subsidize in housing, the people who are working two or three jobs just to maintain a toehold in very poor quality housing, or people who, for example, have been addicted to drugs and or in prison.
And, Gail, is there a lot of reporting about development in L.A.? We have a question from Mary about whether the Palmer ruling prevents the city of L.A. from trying to develop affordable or low-income housing.
Well, it was interpreted that way for a while. The Palmer ruling was the Supreme Court ruled against inclusionary zoning, which is requiring developers of high-end housing to dedicate some of their units to various groups of lower-income people. I think it was very damaging because Los Angeles was going to, at least said they were going to try that, and there's such a tremendous boom in housing in the downtown area that could have generated, and in addition to including other units, they can also give money to build housing for the people elsewhere. So in the downtown area, you know, there's been so much residential development here in Los Angeles and conversions of commercial buildings to residential property, and all of that profit that those developers made, none of it, to my knowledge, or very little of it, went to taking care of the people who have less or of less means. A new ruling with a different lineup of California Supreme Court authorized a limited form of inclusionary zoning, and the city of L.A. is still exploring whether they could require inclusionary zoning going forward. So yes, it definitely hurt, and the feeling is that there needs to be one more ruling or something to authorize that on a large scale for large-scale residential developments in Los Angeles.
And we have just about a minute and a half. I'm wondering what you're all working on right now. Gail, what are you working on?
I'm working on a follow on the woman who died of exposure during the El Nino rainstorm on Skid Row. There were multiple efforts to get her off the streets and help her, and they all failed in the months before her death. I'm also looking forward next week to the the Veterans Administration has a long contested 388-acre property that was supposed to be for veteran housing, but basically all development of veteran housing halted in the 70s or 80s. Next week they're releasing a plan that is supposed to, that the veterans are hoping is going to be a real visionary plan and a model for getting veteran homeless off the streets all over the country.
And Philip, just briefly, what are you working on?
I've spent last week writing about some new figures showing the number of children classified as autistic has risen for the 14th year in a row, risen sharply for the 14th year in a row in California, and why that is and some of the implications of it.
Quickly, do we know why?
Well, there's a few theories. One is that more children are just being classified as the definition's grown broader. The other is that there's environmental factors that are causing some sort of increase.
Tim, what are you working on?
I've got somebody looking into right now the adequacy of the shelter system in San Francisco during El Nino.
Ah.
Because El Nino is a public health crisis in places like San Francisco and L.A. when there's a lot of homeless people who can die of exposure, as we've seen in L.A.
Tim Redmond is founder and editor of 48 Hills. Gail Holland is a staff writer with the L.A. Times. She covers homelessness and poverty. And Philip Reese is a staff writer with the Sacramento Bee. Thank you all for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss intervention programs working to reduce youth violence and gun violence in the Bay Area. Gun violence is not just a criminal justice issue. It is also a public health issue. This month, Oakland's Public Safety Council introduced two new ordinances regulating gun possession. So how will these laws affect gun violence in the Bay Area, and what resources are available for victims of gun violence? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.